Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Foreign Policy Program at Brookings. We're very glad today to have the opportunity to launch Vanda Fellbaugh Brown's new book, Shooting Up, Counterinsurgency and the War on Drugs. And you can get your copy in the Brookings bookstore as you leave this afternoon. Vanda will even sign it for you.
If you ask me a nice question.
Only nice questions. Vanda is a fellow in the 21st Century Defense Initiative in the Foreign Policy Program at Brookings. She's an expert on international and internal conflict issues and their management, especially counterinsurgency issues. And as you will hear in a moment as she talks about her book, the nexus between narcotics and insurgency and therefore the need to develop an effective counter-narcotics policy in order to have an effective counter-insurgency policy. The wonderful thing about Vanda's work and what's reflected in this book is that Vanda does a great deal of field research, in many cases in dangerous circumstances. Wherever we see the phenomenon of narcotics and insurgency intersect, whether it be in Latin America or Afghanistan, Vanda is there talking to the criminals and the drug dealers and the insurgents to try to get a real feel from ground zero on these issues. And I think that as a result, her work is quite unique and represents a real feel that she has from interviewing these people, from riding with them and in some cases living with them, that she has a real sense of what drives them, what motivates them, how they operate, and therefore, as a result, has come up with, I think, some very interesting and even counterintuitive policy recommendations for how to deal with this phenomenon. The phenomenon manifests itself most clearly for US policy today in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And so I'm very grateful that Wendy Chamberlain has joined us as the respondent to Vanda's presentation. Wendy was ambassador in Pakistan before she became Deputy High Commissioner for the UN Commissioner for Refugees. She was also, just before that, the Assistant Administrator of the Asia and Near East Division of USAID, and has had a number of other assignments in the State Department and the National Security Council, including Director General of Global Affairs and Counterterrorism at the NSC. Wendy also has had her own real-time experience dealing with these issues from the US government perspective, and I think it's a very good match and will make for an interesting discussion today. So, without further ado, Vanda, please tell us about your book.
Thank you, Martin. Thank you for moderating today's session. It's a great honor to have you here on the podium along with Wendy. And thank you for the extended introduction. Frequently, people just say, oh, this is Vanda, she does drugs. Shooting Up explores how belligerents, be they terrorists, insurgents, paramilitaries, or local warlords, interact with a variety of illicit economies, how they have penetrated the drug trade, but other illicit economies as well. Indeed, realizing that very many belligerent groups over the past 60 years have exploited illicit economies, many governments have increasingly turned to suppressions of illicit economies, to suppressions of the drug trade, as not simply a means towards suppressing the criminal activity, towards suppressing drugs, but as a means to defeating the terrorists, as a means to defeating the counterinsurgents. Indeed, much of U.S. counter-narcotics policies abroad has been built over the past 20, 30 years on the premise that by wiping out the coca crops or the poppy fields, not only the goal of suppressing drug consumption in the U.S. will be accomplished, but critically that this will enhance efforts to mitigate conflict and shore up vulnerable states. I argue in my book that this message is not correct, that counter-narcotics policies, such as eradication, not only do not are ineffective in the goal of suppressing military conflict, of weakening belligerent groups, but in fact are frequently counterproductive, that they actually enhance the power, the staying power, the capacities of the belligerents. And instead, I propose a different conceptualization of the nexus of illegal economies and conflict, what I called the political capital of illegal economies. As I mentioned, the drugs are the predominant focus of the book, but they are not the sole illicit economy I look at. The book has a theoretical component in which I developed the standard view, the narco-guerrilla view, and my critique of it, and then a chapter that talks about the political capital and really spells out the intellectual framework of the phenomena in the book. And then I have a series of case studies that include Colombia, Peru, Afghanistan, and to a lesser detail also Burma and Northern Ireland. And I also bring in illustrations from Mexico, India, and Turkey to highlight specific points that that I speak about in the conclusions. And in each of the cases, in each of the big cases, I look at 30 to 40 years of conflict and a variety of illegal economies, drugs, but also illegal logging in the case of Peru, smuggling with legal goods in the case of Afghanistan, and other illegal economies in the cases of Burma, Northern Ireland, and Colombia. And in order to do the book, apart from developing the intellectual apparatus, as Martin mentioned, I ended up doing a lot of field work in each of the five main case studies, as well as some field work in some of the additional smaller cases, where I had the opportunity to interview government officials, military officers involved with counterinsurgencies, counter-narcotics officials, other officials tasked with specific policies toward crime, but also belligerents and drug traffickers, as well as the populations, the cocaleros, the poppy farmers, and the broader population that lives in this context of marginalization, insecurity, and conflict. Some of the drug traffickers and insurgents were captured. Others were at large. And that meant that field work frequently required traveling by various means, such as ox carts and canoes, deep into marginalized regions, being ready to down a large amount of liquor with locals at 4 a.m. to toast to friends and break the bad mood, as well as having a finished last will in case something goes wrong. And in many ways, the reason I was able to conduct these interviews, or the method, was really very simple. It involved getting to know a person who knew a person who knew a person who finally was the person. In the conclusion chapter, I provide three sets of recommendations. I talk about how to optimize policies toward illicit economies, such as counter-narcotics policies, with conflict mitigation processes, with counterinsurgency. But I also talk about how to make counter-narcotics policies or policies toward illegal economies more broadly more effective. What under what circumstances eradication works? How can the results of eradication be made sustainable? Under what circumstances rural development works? And what should be the proper sequencing and combination of these policies? And finally, I talk about in the recommendations second and third degree effects of public policies that are frequently not discussed in the public domain, that are not very much part of policy considerations, and yet that have critical repercussions for U.S. policy objective, for security of particular regions, as well as for the populations that exist in this nexus, in this highly pernicious nexus of illegal economies and conflict. So the overriding conclusion is the one that I already started with. That is that policies towards suppressing labor-intensive illicit economies in poor countries is deeply counterproductive from the perspective of counterinsurgency. It does not accomplish the goal of reducing the financial flows to the belligerents. Why is that? That's a surprising conclusion, right? In fact, much of writing, much of public policy has been driven by this idea you need to destroy the illegal economy to turn off the money. And millions, billions of dollars have been devoted to do so. And yet it has not yet happened in one single case over the past 40 years. There has not yet been one policy toward illegal economy that substantially weakened a belligerent group to the point of really weakening and making a difference on the battlefield. And one of the cases I look at is Colombia, and I can talk in Q&A why I don't think that has happened in Colombia and why the Colombia story is frequently misunderstood. Yet the definite effect of suppression of labor-intensive illicit economies that employ frequently hundreds of thousands of, not millions of people in a particular locale is to increase the political capital, the legitimacy and popular support that accrues to belligerent groups that sponsor the illicit economy. And one of the effects of that is that the population is not willing to provide intelligence on the insurgents, on the terrorist groups, to government. And those of you who deal with counterinsurgency know that actionable, reliable intelligence is the most important element one of the absolute key elements in defeating belligerent groups. So one of the recommendations I make is that during conflict, a better policy is either focusing on interdiction, which will not wipe out the illegal economy most likely, but will at least not have the harmful effect of reducing the political capital of belligerents, or adopt a laissez-faire policy toward the illicit economy. It's easily imagined in the case of many illicit economies, such as illegal logging, and has been adopted also in the case of drugs. In fact, not destroying the crops have been the critical reason why countries like Thailand, Peru, Burma have succeeded in defeating very strong insurgencies. Yet military forces have a very critical role to play in helping to suppress illegal economies, and that is by providing security. Without security, no policy toward illicit economy, whether that's suppression such as eradication or whether it's rural development, will be effective in a lasting way. But if belligerents have not yet penetrated an illicit economy, the government should make everything possible to prevent them from doing so, such as by establishing a cordon sanitaire around the territory of the illicit economy. And frequently, belligerents themselves are tempted, at least in the first instance, to destroy the illicit economy, because they find it anti-communist, be it the FARC in the late 70s, or because they find it anti-Islamic, be it the Taliban early in the 1990s. And yet they find that it's unsustainable because it antagonizes the population on which they depend ultimately for their survival. But in this initial instance, there's a great opportunity for the government to come in and exploit the vulnerability that the belligerents cause themselves when they try to suppress the illicit economy. Whenever possible, governments should think about licensing a particular illegal economy. Again, might not be appropriate for many drug situations. I don't think it's appropriate for Afghanistan today, but certainly can be imagined in the case of gems and diamonds. In fact, has been implemented in many African countries, can be imagined in the case of illegal logging, such as in Cambodia. Interdiction efforts are very important, but they should be directed toward reducing the coercive and corruption power of crime groups, not being dominantly focused on suppressing the illicit flows, because that's a rather elusive goal. And critically, governments and their international partners, be they NGOs or multilateral organizations, need to address the demand for illegal commodities. Frequently, that is absolutely critical. It is certainly critical in the case of drugs and should be the focal point of U.S. counter-narcotics policy, not only at home but also abroad. It might not be equally applicable for all illegal economies, for example, suppressing smuggling of nuclear weapons to terrorist groups. Nuclear components might not be at all susceptible to the policy because the groups that are interested in such economy will be highly motivated and demand reduction strategies are not going to work. But it is frequently in the majority of illicit economies the critical element. When designing policies, governments, however, need to consider some of the second and third degree effects. They need to consider what will happen when suppression of an illicit economy actually works. Where will the illicit economy move? So we are all very concerned with the poppy cultivation in Afghanistan. But would it be better from U.S. policy perspective and, in fact, the security of the global community if poppy cultivation is unmasked, shifted to the federally administered tribal areas of Pakistan, which, in my view, is a very likely chance? Similarly, governments need to think what illicit economy will replace the one that they have eliminated. A good example here is FARC. As a result of some of the early coca suppression in the 2000s in Colombia under Plan Colombia, FARC has diversified its portfolio, and we hear stories that they have attempted to trade with low-enriched uranium to make up for some of the financial losses that they have suffered. Surely that's much worse both from the security of Colombia and certainly from U.S. perspective and the security of the global community than FARC continuing to peddle in drugs. And finally, more broadly, when thinking about regulation of any sort, prohibitions, but even issues like sanctions on a country, for example, on Iran, governments need to consider what kind of illegal economy the sanctions, the prohibition or the regulation will give rise to. And whether the illegal economy will be easily susceptible to capture by political elites that the sanctions are meant to target. In conclusion, I would like to a little bit mention more about the intellectual apparatus of the book. I have stressed that the policy of destroying the illicit economy in the context of counterinsurgency or any military conflict, it's particularly pernicious if the economy is labor-intensive and the country is poor. And indeed, I talk about that there are four factors that determine how much political capital belligerents can reap from suppressing the illegal economy. The first one is the state of the country. Very simplistically, is it rich or poor? And so there are very different dynamics in the cases of Colombia or Afghanistan, very poor countries, than in the case of Northern Ireland, where both the IRA and the unionist groups not only did not reap any political capital from trafficking in drugs, the rejection of the community was so strong that militant groups on both sides gave up dealing in drugs and switched to other illegal economies, such as loan sharking and illegal taxation of pubs, that the community didn't find so undesirable. The second factor is the character of the illicit economy. Is it labor-intensive or not? The more labor-intensive the illicit economy, the more pernicious oppression efforts during conflict are, the more political capital belligerents make. So there is a great difference between simply trafficking in drugs and policies such as interdiction to mitigate that and efforts to destroy a labor-intensive illicit economy. The third factor is the presence or absence of thuggish traffickers that are separate from the belligerents. If they are present, belligerents' political capital is greater. And they are frequently tempted to eliminate the traffickers to get greater control over the population, to make more money. But in doing so, they hurt themselves politically because they can no longer put themselves in the position of being the good agent bargaining on behalf of the traffickers, on behalf of the population, against the brutal traffickers. And finally, it is, of course, government policy toward the illicit economy, which can range from suppression, such as eradication and interdiction, to laissez-faire, to licensing for legal purposes, or outright legalization. And I want to stress that the message of the book is not that legalization is the optimal policy. There are very many good reasons why many illegal economies are illegal, and they should remain so. Nor is it necessarily true that if you legalize an economy, that means that the financial income of the belligerents will dry up. You can very well have scenarios where a legal economy robustly exists alongside an illegal economy, or vice versa. Think of the market with cigarettes and cars. Both are legal commodities, and yet you have very robust illegal market in drugs, illegal market in cigarettes, and illegal market in cars, from which belligerents make a large amount of money. So at this point, you might be quite discouraged, don't despair. One of the key messages of the book is that governments can prevail against militants despite the nexus of illegal economies and the immense power, multifaceted power, that belligerents derive from them. And they can do so if they adopt a proper policy toward the illicit economy, if they abstain from hurting large amounts of the population, and if they adopt policies that enable the population to transition via security and the development of a legal economy to the transition from marginalization into being a legal respected citizen of the state. And ultimately, the best way to make sure that the nexus does not threaten states is to make sure that illegal economies and conflict never meet. Thank you.
Thank you, Vanda, very much. Very clearly put. Wendy.
Well, thank you, and I think she's explained her premise far better than I can, but let me just offer a few comments as a reader of her book, which I found to be an enormously valuable contribution, primarily because it debunks conventional wisdom. And as an old revolutionary, I always like that. I know Vanda is a revolutionary, too. It debunks the conventional wisdom that insurgents survive off of the illegal drug industry, and that you can drain the swamp simply by cutting off and attacking the source of their funding. It's a simple solution, and it is simply wrong. And she spends the rest of her book, I think, in a very data-rich book, proving it. But what I really liked about the book, really found valuable, was the intelligent recommendations that she makes at the end for how to go forward. Because after all, that is really the most important value that we can take from a research like this, as we face some very difficult challenges, particularly in Afghanistan. To back up, she places an emphasis on people. Sometimes we can get in bureaucracies and government, we can get all tangled up and all kinds of policy complications. But at the essence, it's what is good for people that is going to provide you the most sound way forward. She takes aim very clearly, strongly, directly at eradication of crops in her three cases that she lays out in great detail. Eradication as the most of all the counterproductive policies, the most counterproductive that you can do, that eradication actually drives people into the embrace of the insurgents, because people who are having their livelihoods destroyed by governments that are eradicating need protection. And who is left if the government is eradicating but the insurgents? The people need protection, and the insurgents provide it from predatory traffickers. Traffickers and insurgents don't necessarily share the same aims, as she points out very well in her book. And finally, people need another kind of security, and that's food security. Many of the cultivators around the world live on the margins of subsistence agriculture. Eradication affects that as well. So it's all about people, and it's all about their security, and it's all about who is, in the end of the day, is going to provide that kind of protection for the people, the insurgents or their governments. It's fact-based and provides for some very entertaining reading. But there are some very valuable lessons to policymakers from this. And frankly, we Americans shouldn't have a problem with building a case counterinsurgency and a counter-narcotics policy based on people. We see ourselves as moral people, as having foreign policies based on principles and morality, and she certainly provides that in her policy prescriptions. But don't get me wrong, morality is slippery, and domestic politics can sometimes, frankly, be thick-headed. I would like to hear more in the question-and-answer period from Wanda on the moral obligations of our government, of Western governments, for protecting our citizens against who are vulnerable to addiction from these crops. Wanda talks about a laissez-faire approach to crop cultivation, where governments, rather than the extreme of eradicating crops, allows certain cultivation to continue as one of the escape valves for the people. And I certainly do appreciate her argumentation for that. But I can also appreciate that governments like our own and in Europe and Russia that are suffering from some enormous addiction rates have domestic pressures that don't understand and put pressures on their governments when we don't pursue an all-out aggressive anti-narcotics policy from cultivation right through trafficking when it reaches the streets of our cities. We suffer some withering criticism, and that has influenced our policy. Now, this the demand side might be beyond the scope of her book, but perhaps we could talk about that in the question and answer. A second observation is to point out the enormous value of shooting up, and is that it does build a data-rich case on the history and the drivers of the opium trade in Afghanistan, which is an area of great concern to all of us, because we have to understand it. We have to understand the history, the drivers, the people involved, if we're going to be successful in affecting what happens in Afghanistan today. Who are the winners? Who are the losers? Who controls the taxing of the poppy cultivation, the trucking, the trading, the refining, the financing? These connections matter. And Wanda's book provides fascinating reading on the complexities of these issues, the relationship between the warlords, the tribal leaders, the Taliban, foreign actors, and it does so over recent history. So I really, really very much recommend it. She describes the importance of the illicit opium trade to the rural economies. And quite simply, the opium trade in Afghanistan today provides jobs. And these jobs go far beyond just cultivation. And this is something that we must understand. Therefore, how it's controlled and who's involved in the poppy industry in Afghanistan provides the, as she calls it, the political legitimacy for not only the insurgents, but also aspiring leaders in Afghanistan, and we have to understand that as well. The undeniable conclusion is that any effort to deny the legitimacy to the Taliban and curtail the opium trade must depend on creating jobs that will be displaced. It must depend on agriculture, crop diversification, market access, credit, rural infrastructure. And for too many years, the U.S. has underinvested in these areas. So she illustrates the consequences, and she does it vividly, when we're discussing recent U.S. Policy over the last few years in the last administration of pushing aggressive eradication. It's what Vice President Cheney called the jihad against the poppy, and how counterproductive that poppy jihad was to our own counterinsurgency efforts. It alienated the people by pushing them further into the arms of the Taliban. Well, the good news and she gets into this and builds a very strong case in her book too, is that we have introduced or are introducing a new policy. The Obama administration has stepped up to the plate and has crafted a plan that is a bit more balanced than a poppy jihad, and that we're makes the case that we're on the right track. Maybe you all have noticed, I think perhaps most of you have, that the midweek, last week, Holbrooke's office issued a 30-page paper called Afghanistan-Pakistan Regional Stabilization Strategy, and it spells out the new approach in Afghanistan. It's also worth reading. It's worth reading because, in tandem with shooting up, because many of the principles and ideas that are well documented in Vanda's book are implemented in this strategy that we are about to implement. The new strategy promises a more balanced approach than just relying too heavily on eradication. And it's based foremostly and primarily on people, on creating jobs in the agriculture sector, as the, as it states, the most urgent of the tasks. This AFPAC policy emphasizes interdiction of drug traffickers and in disrupting their networks. But it avoids targeting agricultural poor. The Obama approach talks about an agricultural policy in terms of sieve mill. Well, this is somewhat new because in the olden days anyway, agricultural policies were run by USAID and civilian agencies, and there really wasn't a military job. In fact, when I was a Foreign Service officer, the military wouldn't touch these kinds of things. It wasn't in their rules of engagement, their scope. But it clearly is now. And the strategy that is laid out, not so much in this paper, but by our military, is to look at where the insurgents are most dense on a map, and that happens to coincide where you have some of the most heavy production of poppy around Helmand and Kandahar. The troops that will have been made available in the surge that President Obama recently approved will be deployed primarily in Kandahar and Helmand, and the theory is that they will be providing security for the local population there. Security from what? Well, from the abuses of the traffickers who force them into debt, from the brutality of the Taliban who prey on them there. But it also provides security for foreign agricultural workers from USAID and U.S. Department of Agriculture to go in and provide some of the services to help the local agriculture build the kinds of infrastructures and crop diversifications, et cetera, that had been so neglected in the past. So this is, they see it, and it is a tied civilian-military strategy. Security has a double edge to it. And finally, the AFPAC strategy seeks to revive cross-border trade so that there's a market for what's being produced in licit crops in Afghanistan. All of this approach is, as I said, fully consistent with what Vanda recommends. But regrettably, and I'll make my last point here, sometimes right policies don't always assure the right the correct results. The third observation and final observation in the book is that it is rich with examples of how government programs can produce unintended consequences. And unintended consequences is rife, particularly in economic development, where it's really hard to get it right. One striking example that she relates in the book, and I'll just mention one example, from 1990, when the U.S. government negotiated with a Mullah Nassim in the Helmand area to curtail opium production in exchange for about $2 million in USAID development projects. Mullah Nasim agreed. He kept his end of the bargain. The poppy crop in that in his area was reduced, but the U.S. government reneged. We reneged when the lawyers in Washington looked at it and said, "Oh my gosh, we don't make deals with narcotics traffickers." And as a consequence, the local population got restive. Nasim's rival, Hekmatyar, got enormously annoyed that he didn't have the opium poppy for the refineries that he owned. And he had him taken out. Nasim was murdered by Hekmatyar's people, and poppy returned to the area. Unintended consequences. There's a great deal of lessons learned that you'll be able to pick out of shooting up. And it's important to do that as we're about to launch this new program in Afghanistan. So in conclusion, the ultimate success of what we're doing there now is going to require not just the right strategies, which I think we're about to have, but it requires flexibility, adaptability, and continuously doing the ground truthing with the local populations so that we can adjust our approach as we proceed and don't end up with yet another tragic example of the unintended consequence.
Wendy, thank you. I realized that I neglected to, in giving your government, former government position, neglected to say that you are now the president of the very distinguished Middle East Institute.
Thank you for the advertisement.
I apologize for that. But thank you for that. And let me come back to you, Vanda, on this question. What is your view of current American policy when it comes to the poppy problem in Afghanistan?
Well, as Linda mentioned, I am encouraged by the changes that the Obama administration has undertaken. In my view, it's not only a right policy for Afghanistan, it also represents an enormous intellectual and policy break for Washington from counter-narcotics policies that for too long have been stuck on eradication, Ibn Alas, eradication first, at the time when it was premature. And let me make clear that I don't believe that eradication is always wrong. I also do not believe that forced eradication is always wrong. In fact, there might be very good circumstances, be it our national parks in California, or other times when legal economic opportunities are available, where eradication is the response that will catalyze populations to switch from illegal behavior. The problem that I have with eradication is that it is undertaken all too often prematurely, at the time when there are simply no legal alternatives available and where there is not security that is absolutely critical for development. And now the administration has realized that. And that also brings me to Wendy's point about laissez-faire that I argue sometimes is the appropriate policy during times of conflict. And it's not because I believe that should always be the policy, it should be the end, but because rural development, economic development, is simply close to impossible to do in the case of insecurity. Apart from the lack of resources that the previous administration has devoted to rural development in Afghanistan and economic development in Afghanistan in general, insecurity has also steadily deteriorated. And so our aid workers, our counter-narcotics workers, have not been able to leave the gates of their compounds in Lashkargah. They have not been able to go out into the field and do the kind of on-the-ground data gathering that is absolutely critical for the success of rural development programs, to understand the drivers, to understand that these drivers are not simply price profitability, but it is the lack of access to microcredit, that is the lack of infrastructure that can be threats by belligerent groups. And unless these structural drivers are addressed, rural development will not work. But to get information, to be able to address these structural drivers, security needs to come first. And the same actually applies to eradication. When eradication has been successfully implemented, it was done after the conflict has ended, after security has been achieved. Be it Maoist China in the 1950s, to Burma in 2000, to other instances. So I am encouraged by the broad changes in the Obama administration policy toward Afghanistan. I am concerned about some of its operationalizations and implementation. I am concerned about the predominant focus on wheat, which I don't believe is an appropriate replacement crop for Afghanistan. I am concerned about some of the ways interdiction against trafficking is being talked about that can easily sap focus of the military effort and can also have at least local effects that approximate eradication. So the broad policy is right, and hopefully the operationalization and implementation will also be, done correctly. But I am more broadly concerned about something that Wendy also mentioned, the domestic politics and the optics of that. The fact is that counter-narcotics policies just take tremendous amount of time. Eradication can give you the overnight satisfaction. You can come to your constituencies and say, we have destroyed 90,000 hectares of whatever illegal crop. It might not be sustainable. It will come back the next year. It might result in the toppling of the government and the strengthening of the insurgents, but it provides quick satisfaction, quick gratification. Rural development, as well as interdiction policy, take tremendous amount of time. And it is especially the case in Afghanistan, the second or third poorest country in the world, with an absolutely decimated human, physical, and social capital. And so I'm worried that even though the administration has undertaken the right policy, it has not sufficiently informed Congress and the public that it is very likely that at the end of next harvesting season, there will be the same amount, if not more, poppy in Afghanistan than there is today. And that doesn't mean that the strategy is wrong. It simply means that the strategy will take time to demonstrate results. And ultimately, the effectiveness will depend on the effectiveness of the counterinsurgency effort.
Just one question here. What's a better crop to grow than wheat in Afghanistan?
Shortly, that is not a simple answer, but essentially it needs to be a high-value, high-labor-intensive crop, which wheat is not. So the rural development should focus on diversified portfolio that include some horticultural goods, almonds, grapes, possibly saffron, which is not, of course, a fruit, but other. And that also include a mixture of very simple vegetables like onion, okra, even cabbage, all of which can actually fetch more money under certain circumstances than opium. So the key is that the structure of the program needs to be to bring food security immediately, to also generate some immediate cash, and to, in the long term, move toward increased profits. But the focus should not be just on the crops. It should not be about chasing crops. It will not work regardless of what the crop is, as long as microcredit is not brought to the people, as long as land rent is tied to opium. The only way today you can rent land in much of Afghanistan is to promise the landowner that you'll grow opium. Unless you address some of it will not work if you don't address roads and develop markets and value-added chains. It's great if the farmers cultivate onions. If they cannot get it across the 20 kilometers it will take to bring it to a regional market, they will not be able to subscribe to that. So the key is focusing on high-value, high-labor-intensive crops in the context of addressing all the structural drivers of illicit crop cultivation.
Can I just add to that? Because sometimes it's wrong to think that a crop substitution for an illicit drug has to be another agricultural crop at all. From my experience as ambassador to Laos, when Laos was the third largest producer of opium in the world, frankly, the best crop substitution in Laos was a road, because the hill tribes people who were producing would come down to the road, would get involved in trade and commerce and trucking, etc., that had nothing to do with agriculture, but did get them out of the production of poppy. So, again, I think the correct emphasis is jobs.
They got into shops, transportation.
Yeah, they got jobs. Jobs within an economy, and that it is—it's really a livelihood question, more than it is an agricultural question.
Yeah, and let me just ask you a question based on your experience in the government, and I know you had a lot of experience with the bureaucratic warfare in this regard, is the U.S. government now set up effectively to implement this policy, which you think is the right one? Or should there be changes in the way we're structured internally?
I don't know the answer to that. Intuitively, I think there's always room for improvement. I think that the way we are structured to deliver assistance overseas is wrong and ought to be rethought. I think that we have a great imbalance right now in government between it's called the three Ds. Both Obama and Secretary Clinton campaigned on the platform of balancing the three Ds, diplomacy, defense, and development, looking at the way it had developed, where so many resources were going over to the Department of Defense. So all the people were, all the logistics, so that when you came to a diplomacy and a development issue, that was the only institution in town that could do it. And I think that this is wrong. I firmly believe that we ought to be rebuilding our development pillar. And let's face it, let's be clear, our development pillar is USAID. That has been allowed to atrophy, not just over the last 8 years, but over the last 15 to 20 years, and that this hurts us when we have a crisis, and this hurts us when we have a situation where the answer is better development. And I personally think that it is the three Ds and not the two Ds, and that we ought to take a very hard look at what kind of intellectual firewalls we have between development and diplomatic policy, because policies can distort the way we approach development. Policies can be short-term, and development has to be long-term, as Wanda points out. So I do, now, there are a couple of big studies going on right now that are looking at this, and that's why I'm not clear as to how to answer the question, because I don't know what's going to emerge from them. But you have the QDD, R, thank you, going on. At the Department of State and Aid, and you have at the NSC a study on the way we're organized in this way, and I trust that they'll come out right.
Do you have a comment on that, the bureaucratic organization structure?
I agree with Wendy that there is, I think, far greater recognition that the structure needs to be improved. There is recognition on the part of many actors, including Pentagon, that aid and our development policy needs to be shored up. And let's remember that remarkable moment when Secretary Gates said in Congress that more money should be given to State Department and USAID. I think there is also greater recognition on the part of the military that they are not simply security providers, but that they are also involved in broader development and state-building work. Nonetheless, harmonizing this realization and synchronizing policy to achieve the optimal momentum is always a challenge, especially in the implementation phase with not simply the bureaucratic battles in Washington, but Congress and earmarking and whole lots of other difficulties.
Okay, thank you both. Let's go to questions. Please wait for the microphone, identify yourself, and make sure there's a question mark at the end of your statement.
There'll be a question mark. I'm Nancy Lubin, JNA Associates, and thank you for a great discussion. And I have a question. I wanted to follow up on a few of the comments that were made more about interdiction than eradication. We work heavily in formerly Soviet Central Asia, have done a lot of work looking at our interdiction efforts there. And in many cases, the international community's vast investment there has only backfired, in many cases, making things worse, the unintended consequences you talked about earlier. So I'm curious, you had made a comment that regarding interdiction, that we should focus on the coercive and corrupt aspects of criminal groups or something to that effect. Could you elaborate a little bit how we can be looking at interdiction in a different light and where you actually see interdiction efforts as having been very successful and why?
Well, thank you, Nancy, and I am aware of your writing and your work on the former Soviet space, on the Central Asian Republic, and I learned a great deal from it. The statement that I make is that interdiction has been dominantly focused on the goal of suppressing the flows of illicit commodities or the flows of money. And its effectiveness in that respect has been highly limited. Capture drug couples that might very well be important, but other drug couples emerge and the trade continues perhaps in a different form. Moreover, the physical resources, the intelligence intensity that's necessary for interdiction is tremendous. And any suppression policy, interdiction or eradication, gives a great opportunity for the people who are charged with that task to become the traffickers themselves. There is no better role one can have if one contemplates a future as a drug trafficker than being in charge of eradication or interdiction in any areas. And so it's very important that we devote great oversight to police forces that we build around the world so we don't create more of the Zetas, the very highly violent armed group cartel in Mexico that were trained as the elite counter-narcotics unit, also with our assistance. However, we should do abroad what we frequently do at home, where we have very intense and successful interdiction operations that, yes, focus on suppressing the commodity, but critical suppress on the goal of not allowing big crime groups to develop a lot of power to intimidate communities, to develop enough firepower to become state-competing entities and to corrupt political spaces. And that might require a very different strategy in what kind of targets we interdict, whether we move against leaders or try to bring down entire networks, under what circumstances. And here interdiction, in my view, is extremely important because it's all too easy to let crime groups go on about their business and alongside of that develop enough firepower and political capital to very severely threaten the inescapable role of the state to provide security and other public goods.
Mm. Let's focus on Mexico for a moment. You also have the domestic implications here in the United States. It's a big hot topic here. How do you deal with interdiction in the Mexican situation?
Well, I think that's exactly an example of what I was actually talking about, where for a long time the Mexican government, or not so long, a few years, have really focused on capturing the big drug apples. And they just recently had several successes with capturing Bertrand Leyva and capturing El Tío. Nonetheless, this has only generated great instability and great violence in Mexico. And in my view, it's not a strategy that's effective in reducing the power of the cartels. What the Mexican government needs to do much more is focus on reducing, on capturing far greater numbers of people from a cartel at the same time to really, really undermine the power of the cartel in the same way that we conduct interdiction operations here. But to do so, it's very intelligent, intensive. It's very much resource intensive. Requires a great deal of cooperation and coordination across the myriad of police forces that Mexico has. That said, I also believe that interdiction simply is not an effective strategy in circumstances like Mexico, where dealing with crime needs to be much more multifaceted than simply focusing on suppressing the security threat. But it also means weaning from crime the populations vulnerable to becoming the soldiers, the young men in the north who have no economic opportunities and who for $500 become hitmen with a lifespan of a few years. The very poor in Guerrero, Oaxaca, and others, some of the southern states who end up being sucked into cultivating poppy or building methamphetamines. The policy needs to be multifaceted, providing security, yes, the inescapable and critical role of the state. That means good police forces and means combating crime. But it also means focusing on the socioeconomic conditions that enable crime to mobilize populations on their side. It also means providing access to justice, to dispute resolution mechanisms. The whole bulk of the public goods that a state needs to provide.
Can I just jump in, just to underscore the whole solution that Wanda talks about with another example of unintended consequences. Back in the days before Mexico became the problem that it really is today, in the very early 90s, and was working on counter-narcotics, the problem then were all these little airplanes that were coming out of Colombia. So our response, unbalanced response, was to get Southcom involved with F-16s, F-15s. That's really fun. It's a good excuse if you're Southcom and aren't fighting a war to be able to make a justification for the procurement of F-15s to follow these little airplanes. And wherever they were interdicted, like in the Caribbean, the traffickers would go another route. And what we were finding is that the little airplanes would be followed by the F-15s, tracked very carefully, tracked very well, very efficiently, and then they'd land in Mexico where we did not have capability to go after them on the small strips in Mexico. The Mexican government did not have the capability in those days, I'm talking early 90s, and we had a devil of a time allocating U.S. resources to provide the Mexicans with helicopters. Mexico wasn't in any command in those days. Where would the money come from? Eventually, I think now we have plugged that hole, but a long time later. Again, unintended consequences. It's whack-a-mole with interdiction, and that's what makes it very, very difficult, as she's pointed out.
Okay, there's a question down here in the middle. Yes, please. The blue shirt.
Good afternoon. I'm Dorian Perez, and I just finished my graduate studies in England. And in the British media, there are reports of how the National Health Service was, there's a shortage on drugs such as morphine. How viable is it politically for pharmaceutical companies or a Western government to be a substitute buyer for the poppy productions in Afghanistan?
Excellent question, one that comes up very frequently. Indeed, there is a shortage of opiates, or at least there is a latent need for far greater amount of medical opiates than is available on the market. That does not, however, mean that there is operational demand, which is critical for the international body, the International Narcotics Control Board, that allocates licenses to distribute licenses. More broadly, while licensing schemes has worked marvels in Turkey and has been more or less effective in India with far greater success, I don't think it's a viable solution for Afghanistan today. And the simple reason is that there is simply not enough security to ensure that farmers will sell to government entity, not to the Taliban or any drug trafficker, because the government doesn't get there. Apart from this overriding problem, there are a whole host of other obstacles like demand, like issues of equity and political internal stability, what tribes, what areas would get licenses. If we give licenses to the north, would it really help trigger ethnic and tribal problems in the country? We certainly cannot give a license to the south. So unless we resolve the security issue and then address a bulk of other problems having to do with demand, having to do with assuring that pharmaceutical companies would buy from there and not prefer the morphine-free, thebane-rich Australian opium that has been displacing traditional producers across the world. It's not an effective strategy right now.
Other questions? Yes, right there.
Hugh Grindstaff. I'm sitting here listening to this and saying to myself, why don't we have a public service announcement saying, you do drugs here, you allow the Taliban to buy an IED there to destroy us? And what effect, did you say what effect, if we did interdict, it would have on the U.S. economy, the gray market for drugs here?
Indeed, the Bush administration had the campaign, you do drugs, you help terrorists. And unfortunately, that didn't really make any dent in demand in the U.S. when they talked about the importance of focusing on the populations domestically in the U.S. susceptible to addictions. In my view, that's a very great concern. And that's one of the reasons why if we ever move toward legalization, we would have to think very hard about it, because the consequences for individuals and for communities of widespread addictions are absolutely devastating. And we have learned that addressing demand through prevention and through treatment is critical. And so it's important that the Obama administration puts its money where its mouth is, and in the budget that ONDCP is to release in February, I believe, indeed, demand strategy will be very heavily emphasized, as they have been very heavily de-emphasized over the past 8 years or so. But specifically with dealing with prevention, we have, however, learned that prevention is only effective if it very much targets the audience that is the primary user. And that messages to teenagers about that they fund terrorists simply do not work. In fact, one of the most effective demand reduction campaigns has been the Montana campaign in meth, where the community Montana went away from saying you do drugs to help terrorists, because teenagers simply didn't care. And they also went away from saying you do drugs, you harm yourself, because focus of teenager has been on much more immediate consequences. And they said you do meth, you will not date. You will be too ugly, you won't get a boyfriend or girlfriend. And we have seen a huge and drop in demand for methamphetamines, and a very successful campaign that is now being studied carefully. So the message here is that demand is critical. We don't necessarily know how much to do it. That's partially a consequence of not really having experimented with policies and having severely underfunded. But one thing that we know is that it needs to carefully target the issue that concerns the user. In the case of teenagers, it's much more immediate to the school, to the home issues, than more abstract things like global politics.
Yes, please, back there. The lady, yes.
Thank you. Julie Werbel from USAID. Thank you very much for tackling this very complex issue. There's certainly a lot of meat here. I'm wondering if you have any hypotheses about not drug-producing countries but drug-transiting countries, particularly looking at the connections between al-Qaeda-affiliated groups in West Africa with the narco-traffickers that are now changing their routes from north to south but going across Africa into Europe, which has overtaken the U.S. as the largest cocaine market. And if you could also comment on local groups and the connection between local African rebel movements and the narco-traffickers, I'd be interested to hear if you have any thoughts on that as well.
Well, thank you. As you mentioned, West Africa especially has emerged as an area of concern, with extremely weak governments, very weak police forces, and increasingly very robust trade in especially cocaine. Because at the same time, in many of these areas, trade in synthetics produced in South Africa, as well as marijuana cultivated in various parts of and cut cultivated in various parts of Africa, have been long-standing, but they have very much not been on the radar screen. There is always a possibility that belligerent groups will penetrate transit routes and trafficking. However, I frequently find that the relationship is somewhat overstated in several respects. Frequently, there are other competitors for doing the job, and traffickers are highly reluctant to share their profits with belligerents. Frequently, belligerents only get share of the profits if they really coerce the traffickers with firepower. So, in my view, the best way of dealing with the problem is with Africa is helping the governments focus on some of the groups we're seeing in Niger, al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, develop the intelligence capacity. More broadly, while we have very strong, robust connections between the Taliban and opium and heroin, the connections between al-Qaeda, in my view, has always been far murkier. and in many ways very tangent. Early on, Al-Qaeda Corps made the decision they will not receive their finances from drugs, even though they get the finances from diamonds and a whole host of legal and illegal economies. Now, the determination may not last, and certainly Al-Qaeda knows people who know people who are deeply involved with the drug traffic in Afghanistan and Pakistan. However, if you think about the cost of 9/11, which economists have estimated at $400,000, if the goal of our counter-narcotics policy in the transit country is to suppress the resources so a group does not earn $450,000, the goal is extremely elusive. The money is a few kilos of heroin or cocaine sold in Western Europe or in the U.S. So in my view, what makes me far more afraid in the context of Al-Qaeda is the shift of opium poppy cultivation to Pakistan, specifically to Fatah, and the great political capital groups like Al-Qaeda, Tehrik-i-Taliban could derive, and the very severe threat this would pose to the Pakistani government if that happened.
Is the Pakistani government focused on this?
No, they're not focused, but there is a happy story in the past where you had a fairly significant poppy production in the Fatah along the border, and some U.S. AID and U.S. State Department INL and DEA projects, very similar to what's being proposed now, which was agricultural development and a balanced approach that worked and virtually, but not entirely, eliminated poppy production in Pakistan along the border, I guess, because everyone believes it just shifted into Afghanistan. So I think the worry is quite real that if you were started to be successful in Afghanistan, it would just shift back across the border into Pakistan. This is one of the weaknesses.
Well, let me pick up on the Pakistan story, because, yes, it was an important success of rural development. Unfortunately, it did not result in bringing lasting jobs to Pakistan.
No.
Much of it was focused on small-scale rural infrastructure. Very popular, obvious, a really good thing to do, has many good, important spillovers. Fortunately, at some point, small-scale rural infrastructure stops generating jobs. And much of the population then simply shifted to smuggling, either subsistence agriculture or smuggling with everything. And so it's important that we focus on Fatah today before we have the emergence of large-scale poppy cultivation again to have a head start, to be able to insulate the country and that region from the susceptibility to wide-scale poppy cultivation. But doing so requires the very hard thing of bringing jobs that last, not simply small-scale rural infrastructure. But I want to say one more thing about Pakistan. It actually is a perfect example of some of the dynamics of political capital and how populations identified with either governments or non-government entity, in this case, tribes. You hear a lot about Afghanistan and Pakistan, Fatah and Afghanistan, that these are deeply tribal society, that they have no respect, no love for the state, and hence nation building or state building cannot be effective. Well, the counter-narcotics programs that Wendy talked about are actually a good sign that many populations have their local identities, but they crave for a state that is effective and that is focused on their needs. So when these programs were introduced, for the first time, many of the tribal elders of the Maliks, of the Khans, but also of the people identified as Pakistanis. They would not say that they are Waziris or that they are Pashtun. The first time they say we are Pakistanis as a result of these programs that took place in the 1990s. And in some ways, that was as important for shoring up, at least temporarily, the region and integrating into it Pakistan as suppressing the poppy or as generating jobs.
Mm-hmm. Let's take one last question, please. Wait for the microphone and please identify yourself.
I'm Bonnie Weinstein. Do you think there's any role or prospect of doing any aerial eradication efforts, maybe in Helmand and Kandahar in particular, and just generally there?
I hope not. I hope that the Obama administration has rejected the spraying campaign. But certainly since 2004, we have periodically seen great moves in the U.S. Government to institute aerial spraying in Afghanistan. And each time it has been rolled back because of in the highly appropriate sense that this will only massively fuel the Taliban insurgency, made state-building efforts close to impossible, and in my view likely result in the loss of the East and the South. But I would not be surprised if a year, year and a half from now, poppy cultivation is strong and the voices that advocate eradication being seduced by the notion that this will suppress the crops, that this will suppress the money, although these notions have been shown over the past 40 years not to be correct, that these voices will be strong again and the pressure for aerial spraying will mount once again. But at least right now we are in a hopeful period.
Last word?
No.
You agree.
No. Read the book.
Well, if you want to shoot up on shooting up, you can get your copy at the bookstore just outside this door there. And Van will be happy to sign it for you. Thank you very much for joining us today. Thank you, Wendy, for being on the panel and for your incisive comments. And especially thank you and congratulations to Vanda on a wonderful book launch.
Thank you.